Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shinoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Thank you again for joining our fourth season, in which we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping industry. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being challenged, replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era.
Hello, everybody. I'm Marco Nunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and the Sci Advisors. And today I'm joined by my co-host, Vic Shia of NASA. Vic, over to you.
Hey, Marco. I'm Vic. I've been at NASA for 15 years. I'm currently the futurist for the Convergent Aeronautic Solutions Project. And I have a background in aerospace, biomimicry, and foresight. Very interested in hearing your thoughts on sustainable energy.
Thanks, Vic. Vic is the serious scientist here. My background is in economics and innovation. I spent the first part of my career at the International Monetary Fund, then in finance, and then a long stretch with General Electric, looking at both global economics and innovation and technology. So my area of expertise is really the intersection between macroeconomics and innovation. And our guest today, most important part of this podcast, is Connie Stacey. Connie is the founder and CTO of Grengen, a clean energy solution company based in Edmonton, Alberta, in Canada. Connie has a BA from the University of Alberta, but most importantly, she's worked in the IT and computer programming sectors. So she's a very successful entrepreneur, often on panels in international tech and innovation events. And her company, Grengen, and Connie will tell us more about it shortly, focuses on engineering and manufacturing batteries, smart battery management systems, state-of-the-art battery energy storage solutions. And so on today's episode, we'll explore with Connie how better energy storage and management can help boost efficiency, energy efficiency, and can help us address the challenges that our energy system faces. Connie, welcome to the podcast, and my introduction, of course, cannot do justice to you. So do you want to tell our audience a little bit more about yourself?
Well, thanks. It's wonderful to be invited to join you today. I have to say, you probably said a lot of nice things about me that I'm not sure I've earned, but I appreciate it just the same. My background, you're right. I actually spent better part of about 20 years in IT when I suddenly had this great idea about 10 years ago that I should move into battery energy storage manufacturing. And it was interesting because at the time, we're still not talking a ton about batteries. I mean, even Tesla at that time was still more of a whisper. And I had this idea that we could tackle problems like energy poverty by making renewables more accessible. And what really came down to for me was finding ways to make battery energy storage systems accessible. Right now, one of their biggest challenges is, you know, things like a renewable system with batteries require a great deal of engineering and technician involvement, which makes it often very inaccessible to people in remote locations or for things like temporary power. So that's really kind of what set me off on my journey in the last few years. And we've been quite fortunate to be successful in a number of awards and projects that we've accomplished over these last few years and gaining some good, let's call it notoriety. In the market.
Notoriety in a good way. So yeah. I'm very happy to hear that. And actually, let me take a step back, man, because you are pointing to the challenges of energy access. And often when we talk about energy storage and energy efficiency, especially in North America, our mind goes to what are, in a sense, the big picture champagne problems, right? The fact that we want to be able to charge our electric cars, we want to make the energy system here more efficient and more relying on renewable, which is absolutely what we should be doing. But we tend to lose sight often of the bigger picture of the challenge of energy access, which especially in emerging markets is daunting still and has very big implications in terms also of the broader pollution and health issues. You want to give us a few numbers and facts to get us grounded in this bigger problem?
Yeah,
Sure. I mean, you're absolutely right. I think in North America in particular and throughout Europe, we're rather privileged in the amount and quality of the power we get, even though the prices have been hurting folks a lot more recently. But when you look globally, the picture looks very different. We're still looking at the better part of a billion people globally that have zero access to energy. So that's candlelight only. I mean, that's effectively one in seven people. And when you look at things like the ability to cook in a way other than to burn something, well, I mean, we're looking at roughly 2 billion people still require on burning some kind of fuel, whether it's wood, sometimes it's garbage or dung even, to cook. And the result of that is actually acute lung illnesses that result in better part of 500,000 deaths a year in Africa alone. So there is a big global problem in terms of energy poverty and even domestic energy poverty, which would be more broadly defined as rampant blackouts and brownouts, maybe only power certain hours of the day, only low voltage power, et cetera. So it's a global problem that is not getting easier necessarily as we continue to electrify, something we must do in order to deal with our climate issues. But it certainly is making the challenge no less daunting.
It's actually something that will connect to an issue that I know is very close to Vic's heart. And so it will come back, I think will come up later in the podcast. But the fact that we have two problems almost feeding on each other. There is emerging markets now are growing very fast. In fact, if I can throw up one statistic, about 20 years ago, it was still the case that advanced economies accounted for over half of the global economy. Today, emerging economies account for over 60% of global GDP. So they've been growing faster. And that is fantastic. It also means that standards of living are increasing. It means that the energy access problem, dire as it is, and you gave some shocking numbers, it's smaller than it was 20 years ago. So access to energy is improving, but that, which is fantastic. It's exactly what we want. But of course, the consequence is that we're looking, unless we do something to change the energy system, we're looking to bring in billions of people more to the kind of energy consumption that is already creating problems today across the West. And so unless we do something, then the climate management, the energy management system, all can assume really unmanageable proportions. So it's kind of good on one side, we were pushing a problem from one side to the other.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one of the things that I always found early on, I did a lot of research when I decided to start my business on energy poverty. One of the stats I came across that was both surprising but made a ton of sense was that economic growth is perfectly correlated to access to energy. So really, when we tackle these big problems of poverty, we can't do so without tackling energy poverty. But obviously, that's a big cost when the infrastructure doesn't exist. A lot of times it ends up that communities or different groups, companies doing work wherever they might be, are forced to use diesel generators, which, you know, it's funny, I always kind of think of diesel generators as kind of the dirty secret. Everybody knows they're out there. Everybody knows that it's a major problem in terms of pollution, but we don't talk about it a lot. We talk a lot about it in terms of vehicles, but we actually kind of brush the conversation about diesel generators largely under the carpet, which is really, it's an unfortunate thing. We had the opportunity to do some work in the last few years with the Canadian Department of Defense. And one of the projects we were working on was replacing their remote temporary camp power systems, getting them away from diesel generators and onto renewables. So we did some calculations for them, and it was interesting. It was, there was a couple of really fascinating numbers. For every liter of fuel that was used in a diesel generator, there were 9 liters used to get that fuel to the site, which was first off already a major problem. And then when we actually started to look at the consumption, it was fascinating. Just at today's dollars, the cost of the fuel for, the Canadian Department of Defense averages about 9 camps a year of about 1,500 people at the camp. And it equated to roughly $40 million bags of garbage worth of pollution. I like to talk in terms of the equivalents rather than the tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, because I can tell you it's just shy of a million tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. But for most people, what does that mean? Is that a lot or is it a little? So instead, I would say, well, that's roughly 40 million bags of garbage. That's the equivalent of how much they're putting out every single year. And the cost is not less. I mean, it's, well, I think in the range of well over 300 million in fuel. I mean, that's not a small problem. So when we look at the numbers on the reverse side, and we talk about the infrastructure that's required, well, not sure it's always as much less than what we're currently playing with these intermediary solutions like diesel generators.
I want to give Vic a chance to jump in, because otherwise I can easily monopolize the conversation. I get very excited on this topic.
So yeah, I was saying very often when we're talking about these issues, we tend to have, again, Western-centric view. When you talk about population growth as an example, while we're focusing here on, let's say, plateauing populations, let's say mid-2050s or so, the developing world is projected to grow, right? And the energy needs are projected to grow. And one of the things I was going to ask you about was, can you change behavior to maybe change the demand? But the point you brought up earlier about people using candlelight, for example. So lighting is a big issue, and having electrification allows education. It allows the healthcare system to function. So you really can't limit the growth of that. So you almost have to change the way people are using technology, the types of energy they're using. And you mentioned the diseases, I think. So there's like, what, 2.some billion people using biomass for cooking. And so how exactly do you start making that behavioral shift? And then are there any successful examples of this having been done anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of things you can do. I mean, and I'm a big believer that growth has to also be inclusive. And I don't think we can look at emerging markets and say, great, we found the solutions, drop all of that dirty stuff and spend 10 times as much money and do it our way. That's not really a reasonable response. And I think that most of the world has come to that realization. And it is, a lot of it comes to looking at things from a different perspective. And, you know, much like we had a leapfrog in things like telecommunications, where emerging markets were able to skip a lot of the infrastructure on telecoms and go straight to cell phones, I think similar things are going to happen and already are happening with energy. Far more use of microgrids, far more decentralization. And I personally believe there is what's called a reemergence of the current wars, where we're looking at whether or not we should be using AC for everything, or if we should be looking at having more DC systems available. And there's certainly, there are a limited number of systems out there that are fully DC. But I think that honestly, there's not actually a lot that stops us from having hybrid. Running extra wire for AC at the same time you run DC, or vice versa, is not really a big cost difference, but it allows us to do a lot of things. So if you look from an energy perspective, you take something like a solar panel, you generate DC current. If you want to put it onto the grid, you have to flip it to AC. So you're going to lose 8 to 10% of that energy on a good inverter. And then you've got line loss. And in North America, where the grid is actually quite robust, you're looking at between 8 and 10% on distribution and transmission line loss. And then you're going to plug in something that has an integrated circuit, so practically everything, and it wants DC current. So you have to flip it back again and lose another 8 to 10%. That's easily between 25 and 30% efficiency loss just in flipping back and forth. And with decentralized energy, there's really not that much that limits us from going, well, we've got DC current, let's store it in batteries and DC current. And when we have things that are a DC mode, like electric vehicles or laptops and computers and phones and anything else you can think of, let's power them with DC and avoid the flipping back and forth. And it's certainly in areas like emerging markets where they're not heavily burdened with existing infrastructure, there's really nothing to stop them from kind of leapfrogging, going to systems that are potentially predominantly DC rather than being predominantly AC. But I think there's certainly room for it to be a mix. The biggest thing I think that holds it up is twofold. One, you already spoke to, which was the attitudes, the kind of mental approach and how we think of it. And the other are some of the tools that we want to aspire to get to. So in an emerging market, often, you know, the first things you're looking for are phone, abilities to cook, abilities to communicate, other types of technology. A lot of that is DC. But there are lots of other things that we all have in our home around the world where they are AC powered, and those manufacturers aren't going to suddenly flip to saying, sure, we'll just make everything in DC. So it's not as simple as pick one or the other. But I do think that the emerging markets in particular have a good opportunity to do some leapfrogging and be far more efficient by looking at where they can stay to DC current. But that becomes a bit of that attitude shift. And it's both for the people who are living there and making those decisions, but also those who are advising who are maybe coming from more developed parts of the world. So you've got that, you know, potentially consultant coming in from a fantastic firm out of who knows where, maybe it's the US or Germany, and they're going to show up and they're say, here's how we do it. But how we do it today might not be the most efficient for that opportunity in the emerging market. So it is a little bit of both. It's the, you know, we have some set ideas in our mind of how systems work, and then we have those who are going to reinforce it. So sometimes the best opportunity is just to take a step back and reevaluate if the things that were true when we made those decisions in the past are still true today. A lot of the things that push us towards an AC grid are no longer issues today or play out in a very different circumstance. So there's a lot of mindset change that has to happen there.
Thanks, so.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
I was also asking about if there are any case studies or examples that you're aware of, but maybe we can shelf that for a bit because I just had another question that I'd like to jump in on. So you talked a lot about electrification and AC-DC stuff, right? So we're also seeing there's a convergence now of, okay, so there's electrification, there is AI, there's a lot of interconnectivity between stuff. And at the same time, there are climate change issues. So for example, there's something like 40 odd million people that had to migrate because of climate change by 2020. And the projection is something like 170 million by 2050. Due to droughts and all of this stuff. So that puts a tremendous pressure on infrastructure and even the potential for, say, I don't know, like terrorism or malicious threats towards this infrastructure that's now amenable to cyber threats, to being hacked and such. So what are your views on that? And how do we build in that safety mindset, security mindset as we're doing this?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And there's a couple of different things there. I guess I'll speak first to some of the security part. This is definitely one that's pretty forefront for me and something we work on quite a bit at Gringen. But one of the things, if you actually look at power systems, most of them actually have pretty limited security. Most battery packs, and for those who aren't familiar, you have cells, you have packs, you have systems. And systems, of course, is the integration of packs with inverters and solar panels, et cetera. And each level needs to have some level of security. And PACs right now generally have effectively none. So if you can find the IP address of a connected battery pack, well, you can hack it. And it's kind of, unfortunately, like cheap Christmas lights. If you take down the leader in the array, you take down the whole array. So you might have, let's say it's a utility size array of half a gig, 500 megawatt hours. That's about 100,000 battery packs. That would be pretty common. If you can take down the leader, you can effectively take down the array. And most of the security is really dependent on you can't get through a basic firewall, which we already know is pretty weak. So battery packs themselves, typically, there are a couple out there that have some basic security, but it is actually pretty minimal. One of the things we did here that I'm super proud of our team about is we took a very different approach. And part of this was being able to look at how can we make batteries and battery technology more accessible. And part of that was understanding, okay, we need batteries to be more intelligent than they are today. And one of the challenges there is batteries effectively don't really self-address. So they use a little dip switch, and you set that dip switch to kind of give mode and addressing and so forth. And if you want to change it, somebody goes and manually changes the binary code. Well, that makes them very difficult for an end user without appropriate background to know how to use it. So what we did is we put all that technology into the firmware and into the pack itself so that when you join battery packs, it will self-identify. So if it's 100,000 packs, you turn on the power immediately. Somebody says, I'm the leader. And everybody else says, I'm a follower. And should interruption happen to the leader, someone else immediately, another pack says, I'm now the leader. Now, that doesn't happen in normal battery systems. And where it comes into play with the security is that what we did is we put 256 bit encryption into each pack. But because if you take down the leader, a new leader is instantly assigned. In order to take down the array, you actually have to simultaneously hack 100,000 packs at 256 bit encryption, which, you know, I mean, I guess it might be in theory possible to do it, but it's, it would be extremely difficult. You compare that to what's happening in the world today. I mean, there's virtually nothing. It's very reliant on third-party components, whether that be inverters, different types of power conditioning systems, etc. And that's still allowing a lot of gaps. I think there needs to be more integration between the different manufacturers and different components, more standards put in place. So packs have security and the inverters have security and the grid control units of every type have to also have security, because right now it doesn't exist. Which means ultimately, in my mind, we will start to see things like energy ransom. You want to get Microsoft to pay you money, you don't have to just get their data. Go for their power. Watch how fast they're going to turn around with a check. So this is one of the areas that I think that not a lot has happened to date, but I think we will see more movement in this space in the future. And it is very ripe for problems because legacy systems just didn't have that type of technology where they were putting in the type of security that we have for things like data. So that's been kind of one of the bigger pieces. And now all of a sudden I'm realizing I forgot the second part of your question.
Are there examples of communities that have successfully transitioned to these renewable or cleaner sources of energy?
Yeah, so mostly it's a mix. Like, we do more work in Canada's north, and hopefully we're looking now more into Alaska. And there are a lot of communities there that do hybrid, where they'll keep something like a diesel generator as part of their backup for redundancy. But they've moved more successfully to solar and wind as opportunities for renewable and cleaner energy. Most of them still, though, I think are, to my knowledge, all very much on AC power. But there are more and more folks looking at how do we be more efficient? Are there opportunities, even if it's something as specific and isolated as, hey, all of the electric vehicles for a particular city, it's a large fleet. Let's make sure that that is charged off DC. So there's more isolated things where I think you can look for specific projects, but not necessarily at a community level.
How does the future look in your mind? Because you're talking about the advances that you guys have made in making battery packs more cyber secure. So I imagine this becomes even more important if we're going towards the future where we're going to have, what, more power companies relying more on renewables and building up larger energy storage systems. Is going to be big corporations setting up their own renewable generation systems with the associated storage systems? Is it going to be all of us contributing more with battery packs, whether it's electric vehicles or battery packs associated to residential solar systems? What does the future, the desirable future and the plausible future look like?
I think there's a lot of different paths we can take. I think the ideal scenario is the industry and the manufacturers start to have a little more agreement on standards so that we can have consistent protection and efficiency and communication across these devices. Because right now it is very piecemeal. You know, as much as batteries have come a very long way in the last 20 years, some parts of it are still very much in the dark ages compared to other areas of technology. So I think there has to be a lot more communication and hopefully standardization, even in things as simple as communication protocols across the industry and all parts of it. I also think that we'll see a lot more folks getting into the energy game, if you will. So right now, obviously, utilities are the game, but there's actually nothing whatsoever that stops, say, a telecom community, a company going in and saying, hey, we're already installing security systems and Wi-Fi in your home. We can also set up some solar panels and a battery, and you can lease that battery from us. And by the way, we'll control that in a virtual power plant. And now suddenly your telecom is every bit as big a utility as your existing utilities. So I think that we will see more players into that game. I think we will see more technology that continues to allow people to be captains of their own fate, if you will, and make those decisions about whether or not they're going to remain part of the existing systems whether they would like to step out and have a little bit more of a secluded approach, but while still living in a metropolitan area. I think we will see changes that way, because there is, as much as the utilities, and I'm not meaning to paint them as bad guys here, but they do have large monopolies and they do have a lot of power, but there's a great deal of money to be made, which means that other folks are wanting their way in, and they're elbowing their way in and making space for themselves. And we will see change. I think that's inevitable, and probably for the most part, a very good thing. I think when we have systems that stay unchanged for too long and unquestioned about their approach, we start to become inefficient. We start to just get efficient at collecting our checks and maybe not so much at looking forward.
No, that's exactly right. And actually, on this point, Connie, I wanted to jump back, if I may, to point we were discussing earlier, which is the issue of efficiency gains that you were mentioning, which, again, I'm looking at it now with my economist lenses on, and thinking also of the question that Vic asked about can we change behaviors? And I'll give you my quick thoughts, and you tell me what we should be doing as a society, because my two quick thoughts on this are, one, we should jump onto any efficiency gains we can, because those are kind of the low-hanging fruit, essentially stuff that we're wasting and we shouldn't. And I was wondering if you can give us also some order of magnitude of what kind of efficiency gains are possible. The second part is, when Vic asks, this is a direct answer to you, Vic, from me as an economist, when you say, can we change attitudes and behavior? I think to some extent, yes. I think what was interesting in, Connie, what you told us earlier, is the extent to which some of our attitudes and behaviors are conditioned by the existing infrastructure, which conditions us to think and behave in certain ways. Beyond that, it seems to me the way you change patterns of behavior is through incentives and therefore through pricing. Because I look at two things. Like I look at emerging markets, and from their perspective, I'm almost less worried about emerging markets in the sense that you have climate change discussions with them, and quite sensibly, the policymakers will tell you, essentially, our people are starving. Our priority is to get them out of poverty. And at the same time, because they are starving, they're also less likely to waste. Whereas in the West is the place where we walk into shopping malls, which are blasting the air conditioning at 65 degrees on a 95 days with the doors open. So that's where you want to change behaviors more. And there, the only answer I have as an economist is find a way to raise the price in the correct way until people start saving more of this. But so these are my instinctive reactions. But you, Vic.
Yeah, really quick. The thing you mentioned about you mentioned the prices, you mentioned the malls and the HVACs blasting. There's a statistic of around, 60%, 70% of our energy use is HVAC systems, I think. And there are some countries where they've started designing cities and they've started designing architecture to use the local wind conditions, to use the local terrain, to do this thermal management more intelligently. And it's related to that behavioral question, but this is more of a societal infrastructure behavior, right? Like design principles. And I'm wondering if that's being taken into account, like urban planning and architecture and such.
Certainly not an expert in the area of architecture, et cetera, but I certainly have seen a lot more projects where people are taking those types of things into account, whether it's creating a facade around an existing building where you create an air envelope, which better controls the heat rather than tearing apart the whole building. And my understanding is those have been quite successful. And you're right. I mean, I don't know the exact number, but a huge amount of our energy is lost in waste heat, in things like air conditioning, and yet we do require them in some parts of the world. I can't even frankly imagine how you would get through the day with the level of heat. I'm being born and raised in Canada, heat is not always my biggest problem, I will happily say. But certainly we do use air conditioning in the summer. It does get quite hot here, and plenty in the winter. We're flipping on the heat and we're turning it up quite high. In terms of the behaviors, I mean, and the incentives. I mean, Vic, I think you're hitting on a couple of really important things. Part of it, I think we've already seen on the consumer end of things, you see a lot more time of use costs. So we're going to charge you 22 cents a kilowatt hour for your electricity at dinner time, but only 5 cents overnight. So encouraging people to go, well, maybe I can run that dishwasher overnight rather than running it at dinner time. So there are certainly a lot more of it that we're seeing. And the flip side to it for the emerging economies where they're trying to build up their industry and need to do so. I mean, it is, you can't expect them to put environment over starving people. I mean, I don't think that's an ask that anyone can really make and do so without, or do so with a straight face, I guess. And when you look at how large industry works, you actually nowadays, the efficiency of like behind the meter BESS systems, you can actually, most of those systems pay themselves off, at least the ones that we've been doing. Typically, they range between 2 and 5 years. And that is a fast turnaround, much faster than solar, actually. And that's without solar. You know, you add solar, you add another clean level, but you're avoiding emissions by timing when you have your electricity, and you're timing that low to lessen the impact on the grid. Well, that's a big cost savings. I mean, I think in where I am right now, it's quite low, and you pay about $20 a kilowatt for your demand charge. But it's certainly, I've seen numbers in Europe that are upwards of 300 euros. I mean, that's a completely different thing. If you can cut, you know, 2 megs off of your peak and it's, you know, 200 or 300 euros a kilowatt, boy, does that pay itself off pretty fast. So I think that we will start to see the numbers there. I think the biggest piece that holds it back is not the economics of it, but the upfront capital. One of the biggest things I've seen is what holds companies back, whether it's in North America or in emerging markets, is you have a big capital cost. So we're working, I'll leave the names out. We're doing some contracting right now with a big mining firm. And the system for them, they actually have so much operational loss from an outage. And if you're not aware, typically, even when you have a diesel generator, they take, let's say, 30 minutes to get up to enough revolutions to take on a plant load. So if you have something with sensitive operations that, say, needs cleaning, well, for this particular company, even if the outage is 5 minutes, they have 3 days down. So the system we're putting together literally pays it for itself in 2 power outages. Like, we're expecting 3 or 4 months on a multi-million dollar system. The challenge is it's a CapEx spend. And, you know, everything has to go up the chain of command to the board to say yes. And then they have a question and it comes down the chain and we answer it and it goes up the chain and then it comes down the chain. And it takes a very long time. But if you flip the same thing and actually put it on an OpsEx budget, where you're now talking about a lease or a lease to own model, suddenly you can actually flip that very quickly, because you put in front of the finance folks, and Marco, you would know this best of all, if you put in front of a finance group, hey, you signed this contract with us for 7 years and we're going to cut your electricity bill by $40,000 a month. Boy, how fast can I sign that contract? But CapEx versus OpEx becomes one of the bigger pieces. And I think in emerging markets, that's one of the things that holds them up. If the financing is there to allow them to reap the benefits without the big upfront capital costs, I think it can move much faster. So I think we are seeing that. I think we've seen pieces of that in the past with PPAs, but those mostly were focused on solar. I think they have to be more inclusive now of bigger systems that, for example, include battery.
Spent some time at Autodesk and looking at the construction industry, and there I've seen some interesting examples of using artificial intelligence for generative design, exactly to try to come up with buildings designs that are more energy efficient. Is there a broader role for artificial intelligence to play here to help us increase the efficiency of the energy system overall, especially thinking of how we use energy storage and match it to demand and supply?
I think it's on a couple of different levels. On a very broad macro level, having the ability to fully understand what resources are available on our connected grid, regardless of who owns it, and operating in a way that can anticipate who's going to have loads at what times. That by itself is an enormous challenge that the grid operators are dealing with today. And machine learning has the opportunity to take that to another level of efficiency, a very big step, I think. I'm not sure what that number is, but I think it is significant and worth pursuing. And I think that one of the challenges is really understanding what resources are there. Because right now, I don't believe most grid operators, for example, have a lot of idea of what's happening on the private or privately owned side of the assets. So, you know, obviously people have to go through permits to get them approved, but they're not monitored, I don't believe, or not in the systems I've seen. So, you know, if there was a better agreement, standards, communications, et cetera, where those private assets could participate, then I think machine learning could take another big step on how we're doing in terms of efficiency, managing load. And if you think about it, it's really the problem a lot of times, certainly a lot of what we face in North America is not the total volume of energy. It's the volume at any one given time. You know, overnight, we're using very little. So if we could levelize that load, which requires storage, then we have an opportunity to do a lot more. The other place where I think machine learning and AI can really play an important piece is right now, I always like to say, when batteries are in the wild, once they've left the factory and you're done the factory testing, they get out there. There's actually limited data available, but what's really happening. So a particular company like us, we can see what's happening with our systems. But for example, if you look at a cell manufacturer, they could have cells in who knows how many different systems around the world. And there's no data collected at that point. You can't trace it back to that cell manufacturer, for example. And even within packs, there is a limit because somebody can buy a pack and put it into a small, you know, community center somewhere, and the original manufacturer of the pack sold it to a solar distributor and they have no idea where it ended up. So I think that there is that opportunity to start gathering data at a much bigger level. And so, you know, taking the ability, okay, if we've got packs out in Johannesburg, well, what's the altitude? What's the temperature? What's the humidity? All of those types of things combined, and then feeding that information back into a broader system that says, here's how these cells are performing in a variety of settings all over the world. Now we're going to get data that has previously been very unavailable or only at very small level. And now we can really dig into what machine learning does best, which is analyze the patterns and find out what's really happening. I think there's a lot of efficiency that we're going to gain when that type of data becomes available.
That's fantastic. That's exactly what I was hoping to hear. And now, since we're coming towards the end, Vic, let's close with the archaeology.
Archaeology, sure. We usually close with some takeaways, but I'll leave that to you, Mark. I was going to say there's this ancient city that was unearthed called, trying to remember the pronunciation, I think it's Derinkuyu in Turkey. And it's from about 5,000 years ago. And so they built it underground, so it's like a labyrinth, I think around 20,000 or so population. But I think that kind of thinking might start to come back. And you're seeing many countries start to build factories and settlements and malls underground because it's easier to do thermal management when you're underground. So that's what I was... It might be interesting to see the new kinds of concepts with... You mentioned AI, right? And if you just release the paradigm of we must build above ground, there's all kinds of things we can come up with, different types of energy.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I actually, one of the examples I like to use when we think about just following patterns from history without looking back and finding what we maybe did things better before. We built a lawnmower based on the idea of, okay, we're going to replace a scythe and we're going to get this big blade spinning around really fast. We'll mow our lawn super efficient. And then, you know, you look today and go, you don't need a machete to cut a blade of grass. So why do we still make lawnmowers with machetes effectively? We can do this with something much lighter and smaller that requires a smaller motor and is going to use less energy than what we currently do. And yet we've stuck with that model for a very long time. But if you look back and you think back to something as simple as the scythe, well, why did we use it? What was efficient about it? And I think the same is true. We look back at... You know, whether it's building underground, and that's certainly, I don't know this particular city you're referring to, but now I'm really curious to go find out. So feel free to share a link. But yeah, I think if we look back at other systems, there have been great efficiencies that have been done in terms of energy, in terms of building styles and building materials. I know one of the things I read, gosh, it was a few years ago now, but around using, I think it was Japanese architecture, used a hemp lime concrete that was, it lasted forever. And the stuff is a carbon capture. And now all of a sudden you see more and more people coming out with materials using something similar where, hey, this is a great material. It is, you know, it is equivalent to a concrete for the most part. It's pretty much not flammable, and it's a carbon capture on top of everything else. So I think we are starting to look at some of those historical things and going, what can we learn? What have we forgotten? And sometimes I think we got too smart for our own good and said, oh, those people in the past, what did they know? They didn't have technology. But sometimes the fact that they didn't have technology meant they were very efficient in what they did.
Right. Just your lawnmower comment, it looks like there's what, 85,000 injuries a year from lawnmowers, and almost half of that is lacerations. So yeah, good point.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I wasn't even thinking of the health and safety factor. I was thinking of the energy, but absolutely. And I mean, quite frankly, I have one of those little whippersnippers, and it has just a piece of plastic, and it cuts the grass just as well.
Yeah. Right, tying it back to aerospace. So you have these blades. So is there an analogy there?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, well, you're the aerospace expert, so I'll have to leave that analogy to you.
There might well be. Right? This actually helps me a lot with the takeaways for our discussion, because we kind of already knew that energy storage holds the key to a better energy system if we really want to move towards a greater use of renewables, because we know renewables are intermittent. So a better energy system requires a much better system of energy storage and management. And I think, Connie, for the takeaways for me are, first of all, that already very important and encouraging work is being done, in this case, by encouraging entrepreneurs like yourself to improve the underlying technology, including through better security, better cybersecurity, better efficient, better monitoring that can help and will help storage, energy storage systems play a bigger role. And the other big takeaway, which comes from comments that both you, Connie, and Dick have made, is the importance of looking at this through a broader lens. So thinking about changing behavior, thinking about what are the pieces of the system and the infrastructure that we are taking for granted, and we shouldn't, because they've been put in place under different conditions and they could be replaced, and how big are the efficiency gains that can be reaped by doing so, which are really of stunning magnitudes. And finally, there's this looking in a broader way includes archaeology. So it also includes looking at intelligent people, intelligent things that people have done in the past and we should be rediscovering. So these are my takeaways. But Connie, you, we'll give you the last word. Anything that we've left out, anything that you would like the audience to know?
Probably a million different things. But I guess the thing that stands out most for me right now is just, it is about our mindsets and opening ourselves to the ideas that there are other solutions, and sometimes just a different approach with the same technology can result very different and better results. And we can get pretty stuck in our ways. This is how something is done. If we really stop and step back and look at the technology as a tool, I think it starts to change, right? I know we've spoken with a number of Indigenous communities here in Canada, and you know, they'll ask me, okay, well, what should our system be? And I said, what? I've got the tool. You tell me what you need the system to do, and I'll show you how I can use a tool to accomplish it. And sometimes we take a different approach. We see the tool, the battery, the solar, the whatever is the end all be all. It's not. It's just a tool. And I think if we start to look at it from that perspective and going, well, how are we meant to use it? What are we trying to accomplish? And stop focusing quite so much on the particular features of a technology, I think more answers will open up to us.
That is an excellent note to end with. Connie, thank you so much for being with us. These were fantastic insights. We really enjoyed having you on. Big thank you as well. Always fantastic and inspiring having these conversations with you. A big thanks to our audience. Again, remember, you can find this Ecosystemic Future podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. So give us a thumbs up, share them, and keep an eye out for the future episodes. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactored business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shoshimeworks.com.